Following the philosophy that Neil Tarak has proposed for our side courses, there will be 3 weeks and three ideas or topics. Okay, so week one is going to be the theory of normal metals and Fermi liquids. Week two will be conventional superconductors, by which I mean BCS type superconductors. And week three will be unconventional metals and superconductors. And so this will touch on, to the extent that is possible in a week, things like high temperature superconductors, mod insulators, spin charts, or whatever we can fit into that week. Okay, so that's the broad plan. The plan for this week is, I'll give you slightly more detail. We're going to start off with an introduction to some basic ideas. We'll then talk about non-interacting electrons. Motion in a periodic potential. Energy bands. In particular, nearly free electron and tight binding. Fermi surfaces, very, very briefly. Then Hartree-Fock for fermions. Landau's Fermi liquid theory. And then if there's, well, there has to be time, transport it. So this is all introductory material. Many of you, the ones who've actually been through some condensed matter, will have seen it before, but the approach that I'll take is for people, it's not expected that you've seen any of it before. If you want me to elaborate on some of the concepts beyond just the introductory level, feel free to ask questions. This is very much review, and these are a little bit more substantial, but that's to provide you with the basic framework that you'll need to understand more interesting electronic systems. Okay. So let's start with the basic problem of condensed matter physics. In fact, let's start with the basic Hamiltonian. Okay, it's It is very basic, and we know it quite well. There's the kinetic energy of the electrons. There's the kinetic energy of the nuclei. There's the interactions between the electrons and the nuclei. There's electron-electron interactions. And there's the interactions between the nuclei.
John?
Yeah?
Why is the
These have the same charge. These have opposite charge. I'm just taking E to be.
I mean, it's
oh, sorry. It's minus. Is that del squared? E to the I k dot r del, bring down two i's, make it positive. Kinetic energy is positive. Okay, is that right? Yeah. Okay. Okay. So that's it. You know, you can write down. We know these interactions perfectly. We can write down this Hamiltonian, and the only problem is to solve it. Okay, and that's it. And in fact, it's even simplified by certain things. The mass of the electron is much less than the mass of the nucleon. We tend to have charge neutrality. So we're dealing typically with neutral systems. And it's non-relativistic. So that everything you learned about relativity, you won't need. With one small exception that for heavy atoms, heavy ions, if the electrons are moving quickly around the nuclei, then you can get some effects called spin orbit interaction, which result in, say, some anisotropy that you otherwise wouldn't have in the spin-spin interaction, or the effective spin-spin interactions in the system. Okay? So, but other than that, and you can just write that down as an effective interaction, so you don't really need the relativity that went into calculating the effects of spin orbit coupling. Yeah, Anna?
What are the dates in the alpha?
These are the charges of the nuclei. The what do you call it? Atomic number, or I guess it is? Yeah. Okay, and actually, this Bob Laughlin loves to describe this as the theory of everything. But I won't go further on that. So what's the problem? I mean, why is it that people are still studying condensed matter if they understood the underlying physics for decades, almost centuries now? And the answer is, well, really, this is actually a strongly interacting many-body problem. It's a difficult problem, as I'm sure you well know, once you put more than a few particles together that are interacting in any significant way, the problem quickly becomes intractable. Okay, so this is a strongly interacting many-body problem. So, in fact, I would go from saying, well, look how simple it is, to saying, well, actually, really, it's impossible. I mean, there's no way that you can make, well, how should I say it? Insight and experience have resulted in insight into the solutions of this problem, assisted by the fact that we can observe in nature what the solutions are. And so so we have that advantage. So there are certain simplifying aspects that start to make this problem tractable. So what are the simplifications? So what would you say is the zeroth order level of simplification which reduces the complexity of this problem? That would be, yep?
No.
Say you're given this problem, and what is this problem? This problem just says that you put a bunch of nuclei into a box and you throw in Z times as many electrons, and then it solves itself. So what's the first thing that happens when you do that?
Well, yeah. I can say that some of the electrons don't interact because some of them are binded to the nuclei.
Right. Well, that's okay. So, I would say it slightly differently. I would say that the first thing that happens is that most of the electrons get sucked up by the nuclei to form ions, and the ions, which still may not be, you know, neutral atoms, but which could be, but the point is that if you're willing to say that you can solve the problem of a electrons forming an ion with a nucleus, then that's a great simplification, because then that's a relatively rigid object. It has some size now. It has some larger size than the nucleus. It has some charge. And the number of electrons that you have yet left to account for, the ones that are still floating around trying to figure out what to do, is relatively small. So there's an enormous simplification that they form ions. And then if you then just jump ahead, what would the next level of simplification be? Okay, I mean, it'd be interesting. I don't know whether you would think about this the same way as I would, but anyone care to guess? Yeah?
Those things are stuck in a lattice?
Well, that's one possibility. Okay, so let me just say because you can't read my mind. Let me just say that the next thing that's going to happen is that these things will form some kind of condensed phases, or uncondensed phases for that matter. For instance, So examples of phases of matter, which you're all familiar with, would be solid, liquid, gas. And so, Felix, there's your crystal. Okay. So that's one way of organizing matter. Another way of classifying phases of matter would be metals, insulators. We put semiconductors here. Semiconductors being just insulators where the gap is relatively small on some scale.
Yeah? Why don't you put metals, insulators into stellate.
Okay, so I'm classifying in different ways now. Okay, so this is one way of classifying condensed matter as being gaseous or liquid or solid. If you then restrict yourself, say, to solids, let's say, then those might be metallic or insulating or somewhere in between. Superconductors are a phase of metals. I mean, you normally think of metals as being conductive and resistive, but if you cool them a bit, many of them will become superconducting, which means that they have infinite conductivity at DC or and other interesting properties that we'll talk about. You can also have magnetic phases. Such as ferromagnets, where all of the magnetic moments have a tendency to align parallel to each other, and they have then dramatic magnetic properties. Or antiferromagnets, where the magnetic moments align in a more complicated way so that they don't actually add up to much, and you have to look very closely and using special tools to understand that they're antiferromagnetic. Yeah?
So the superconductors, is that a new classification by itself?
Or it's just a phase. It's actually a phase of a metal.
Okay.
And this is these can be phases of either metals or insulators, actually. But the point to this is simply that if you have a condensed, if you have condensed matter, which has adopted or condensed into a particular phase, then all of a sudden, the problem of understanding its properties has been enormously simplified. Okay, so I mean, this is a very quick trip from complete dissociation to highly organized behavior. Okay, but nevertheless. There's still a lot left to understand about, well, a lot less, but there's still significant work in understanding the properties of these highly organized phases. Okay, so so those are, I mean, that gives you an idea. Where are we in this? Okay, in this course, we'll be looking at well, a little bit about solid liquid gas, but hardly anything, only insofar as it pertains to the electron gas. We'll be looking at metals. We'll touch on insulators in the sense that there's an instability where something goes from being a metal to an insulator called the Mott transition. We'll look at superconductors in detail. We'll also look at magnetism sort of from time to time as we go through the course. And it's an interesting thing that these two properties, magnetism and superconductivity, were once thought to be like oil and water, that they would always be separated. But nowadays, the interesting types of superconductivity are ones that result from magnetic behavior in solids.
Okay.
Yep. Say that again?
Is that theoretically the talking about?
Theoretically. You mean the fact that these two are were considered to be anathema? No, I think that for the kinds of superconductors that were originally discovered, magnetism did not play an important role. And then as new superconductors were discovered, in particular the high temperature superconductors, then magnetism seems to be much more closely linked to that phenomena. Felix?
Does anyone have superconductors in things other than solids?
Well, yeah, I should say not me, but I guess the phenomena that are related to superconductivity are thought to occur in extreme forms of matter in the interior of stars and things like that. So, I mean, so the point is that for superconductivity, all you need to do is get a gas of fermions with some kind of, well, effective, attractive interaction, and then it likes to find that ground state. And so if you can imagine in nature places where that occurs, other than in a piece of lead or niobium, and there certainly are, presumably. So yes. So that theory, I guess, comes up in theories of stellar matter and so forth. So I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page with regard to thermodynamics and statistical mechanics, and we're not going to do anything too deep here, but let me just say, actually, we probably will do something moderately deep here. Okay, so the systems that we're going to be studying are characterized by a temperature. T, which is related to the energy and entropy, internal energy and entropy of the system. They're characterized by a chemical potential. Which is related to the number of particles, or the particle density. If you crank the chemical potential up and down, that's forcing particles into and out of your system. And of course, is related to the thermodynamic pressure. So the temperature describes a system which is in contact with some kind of a thermal reservoir. I just want to make sure that you all are fully comfortable with the concept of temperature. The idea is that the system you're studying is connected to some kind of large stable reservoir. They can exchange energy. The properties of the reservoir then determine the equilibrium configuration, which is when, on average, your sample is no longer exchanging. In other words, its average energy doesn't change with time. Okay, so that's thermodynamic equilibrium. Equilibrium means nothing change. I mean, that equilibrium means that there's some well-defined long time average. Okay, and you know, functionally, this is exactly what happens in an experiment. If you think of doing an experiment at low temperatures, you put your sample inside a cryostat or inside of a refrigerator, and through really clever engineering, that refrigerator, you can turn a knob or dial something, and it establishes the temperature of your sample. Okay, so this thermodynamic concept translates directly into what people do in experiments. Similarly, your, say, metal sample, which has electrons in it which are free to move around, it can be as well. It will have some well-defined chemical potential, and you can control the chemical potential by connecting it to a electron reservoir. How do you do that? We all understand how to connect your, put your sample in a cryostat. How does the metal sample get connected to an electron reservoir? Yeah.
Earth it.
Say that again?
Earth it.
Yeah, right. It's connected to some wire, right? Some wire which also has electrons. Electrons are free to move in and out. The number of electrons that stay in the sample are the right number for the given piece of wire that it's connected to. Okay. So that's another kind of reservoir. Okay. Well, actually, that's all I want to say. Well, that's not true. So your system, which is at some temperature and connected to some particle reservoir, is described by a probability distribution. Which you can call a density matrix. Or a density operator. Okay, and you've learned all about, I think in your quantum mechanics course, you learned all about density operators, okay? So this is a little bit different because this is for a system with a temperature. Okay, so the density operator rho is e to the minus beta h over trace and beta one over kT. The Boltzmann constant here is the fundamental constant of nature that connects the temperature scale to the energy scale. And we'll almost always set it equal to one. And what's this good for, this probability distribution? Well, what it's good for is thermodynamic averages. If you want to calculate the average quantity of any operator that, any property of your system, you calculate its average as trace rho A. So these operators, A and rho, are operators in the Hilbert space of your many-body system. And that's what rho is good for. Also, the entropy is minus where I've set the Boltzmann constant equal to 1, which is, by the way, from this definition, is just the average of the log of the density matrix. And the free energy the internal energy, I meant to say. So the internal energy of your system is just the thermal average of the Hamiltonian of the system. And the so-called free energy, this is called the Helmholtz free energy. Something which I always have to forget and look up. That's that. Also, there's something called the partition function. Which is and if you put all that together, you can write the free energy as minus T times the log of the partition function. This you show by from those basic definitions. So the free energy is a function of the temperature, the volume, and the number of particles. And what's useful about this function is that if you know it, you can calculate all the thermodynamic properties of your system. Okay? So for instance, the entropy is minus df dt at constant V and N. The pressure is minus df dV at T and N. The chemical potential is minus, I hope I've got my minus signs right, df dN constant T and V. So if you know this function, the free energy, as how it changes with temperature, volume, and number of particles, or particle density, you can calculate the entropy. You can derive the entropy, pressure, chemical potential of your system, and other interesting properties. The specific heat, then, is a second derivative of the free energy. And you can also relate it through this statistical mechanics. The statistical mechanics is this. You can relate it to the mean squared fluctuations in the energy of the system. And I'm just skimming the surface here, of course. But the you can equally well derive relations for this is a similar thermodynamic potential function, which where instead of writing it as a function of TV and the number of particles, we've written it as a function of TV and the chemical potential, and then the number of particles will be some derivative with respect to the chemical potential. So this is like a grand potential function with variable particle number. Okay, and you can derive similar expressions for, I guess, S, P, specific heat at constant chemical potential, and so forth. Okay. So I'm not going to delve any more deeply into statistical mechanics and thermodynamics as a general subject here. If you have any questions, though, feel free to ask them. I'd just like to go off in one particular direction. and that is that there is a variational principle. And the variational principle says that if you consider something that looks like a free energy, but really isn't, let's call it curly F. And its argument is P, not to be confused with rho. So this is a function which looks like the free energy. And in fact, if this had been the density matrix, e to the minus beta h, this would be the free energy for that Hamiltonian. So this is the Hamiltonian of our system. However, this thing here is totally arbitrary. That's why it appears over here. Okay. So imagine some totally arbitrary probability function. Then the variational principle says that the minimum over all possible p's is equal to F. Oh, sorry, that's not exactly what I wanted to say. Let's write it this way. Okay, so this is the H that you're trying to solve. Tibra.
Sorry, the P is a polynomial. What does it mean for P? Is it positive and stuff like that? Or?
Yeah, trace one, positive definite. It operates in the same space as your H. Okay, so if you like, if you were given a Hamiltonian and you didn't know how to calculate the associated probability distribution, you could do this calculation and just vary this function over all possible probability distributions, and if you took the one that gave the lowest free energy, that would be the right one. And in fact, it would turn out to be exactly this. Okay. So I leave that as an exercise. I mean, it's not even a homework or tutorial problem. In fact, you can look it up on Wikipedia. It's attributed to Bogoyuvov, which I had never known before, actually. Okay, but let's just go on, because we just want to use this. So a general way of writing P is like this. So this is just a reparametrization. Instead of varying all of the different probabilities for the energy eigenstates of H, which is the way that you would minimize this, you instead express this probability distribution in terms of a Hamiltonian, which is in the same Hilbert space as your problem that you're trying to solve, and which is totally general. And then you vary things with respect to this variational Hamiltonian. So then I would make a number of statements about this. This variational Hamiltonian. Okay, maybe I should just make a little comment here. The value of these one value of these variational principles is to allow you to develop approximation schemes, ways of approximating the solution to a problem that you don't know how to solve with something which is a good, at some level, a good approximation. Okay. So obviously, the best variational Hamiltonian is the one that you started with, the one that you're trying to solve. Okay. And then there's no variational freedom left. Okay. But if you're going to try to work with a variational Hamiltonian to obtain some kind of approximate solution to your problem, then HV is most useful. If it is exactly solvable. Okay. So that's one statement. And of course, as I said, typically H is not. If you want to make a better variational Hamiltonian, it's useful to include variational parameters in HV. I like to call this a fake Hamiltonian because, as it's used in the business, there's often a temptation to treat it as if it was your real Hamiltonian, and that's led to countless errors. So just to remind myself, call this okay, so you've been warned. Okay, so what's an example of a useful variational Hamiltonian? And this special case is essentially universally called mean field theory. And that is when you consider a variational Hamiltonian, which is sum over all of your particles, So where this is a one-particle Hamiltonian, which contains the coordinates, which can be written in terms of the coordinates and momenta of a single particle and its spin. Okay, so that's, but is otherwise totally general. And then that is a basis for what is called mean field theory. And the terms in this one particle Hamiltonian will contain mean or effective fields which act on particle I and which are intended to reflect the effect of the action of all the other particles on that one particle. And that's why this is called a mean field theory. And so the idea, and then the hope is that by calculating the best possible one particle mean field Hamiltonian, you will obtain insight into the actual behavior of the system, the actual solutions of the full many body Hamiltonian. And in fact, it's interesting. Sometimes you can obtain extremely useful and accurate results, and sometimes you get things which are enormously different from the actual behavior of the many-body system. So it also, I want to alert you to the fact that minimizing the variational free energy leads to what are called self-consistency equations. Or call them conditions if you like, which determine the mean fields.
So what is
FB? Oh, it's the trace of e to the minus beta HV. You know, it's just another disturb in the it's the variational free energy. So far what I've said is pretty well what you would hear in classical statistical mechanics. Of course, we're only interested in this course in quantum statistical mechanics. It turns out it works equally well. For identical quantum particles, in fact, the way I've done this is a setup for the identical quantum particle problem. And it's when you apply this to identical quantum particles, be they bosons or fermions, this is called Hartree Fock. So you guys have studied Hartree Fock? Yes? In some quantum field theory course? Here at SOC? Okay. So what you've done, I guess, is you've done some diagrammatic perturbation theory where the lowest order diagrams would be associated with the Hartree-Fock calculation. So I guess it's one loop or something like that. Okay. But probably nothing that involves self-consistency or self-consistent field equations. So we're going to use this The normal Fermi gas. So the normal Fermi gas and BCS superconductor. We use Hartree-Fock to calculate those properties. Okay, so let's step back again. And I want to say something about non-interacting electrons. So the Hamiltonian for non-interacting electrons sigma is a spin quantum number. Call it plus or minus one, or call it up or down, whichever you like. Yep.
Which squiggly thing?
They're all squiggly. This is a Q. That's a Q. Okay. There's a vector. It's a vector. I don't know how to do bold on the in chalk. Okay. So what do we got here? We've got kinetic energy. I've referred all the electron energies to the chemical potential. So that just adds a constant. For a given number of electrons, that's a constant. I'll ask you whether this notation is familiar to you in a second. But let's just say that we'll work. And condensed matter theorists' favorite device, periodic boundary conditions. Okay, so just to make it easy for you to visualize in three dimensions. R, psi, q, and sigma of R. Okay, now we have almost, yeah.
Sorry, what does the chemical potential come from?
What does the what?
The chemical potential.
Yeah, so you put electrons into a box in, let's forget about their charge for a minute, in equilibrium with a particle bath, which is defines a chemical potential. And so if you like, this is the thing whose phrases.
Okay, equilibrium with some particle bath.
Yeah. Or you could just say that if you're working with a fixed number of particles, then this term here is just a constant because the sum over this thing here is just going to give you the number of particles. So that then would just be minus mu in. Okay. So that's just but the idea is that it's in equilibrium with a particle bath with chemical potential. But anyway, let me just go back now. I just want to make sure that you're with me. These operators create and destroy electrons in these states. These states are normalized so that each one describes one electron in a box of volume V. Okay? And nothing depends on spin, so there's the same spatial wave function for spin up and spin down, because we haven't done anything, made anything depend on spin. So there's a couple more things that I, oh, so then let's just say for the C's, the operators obey the anti-commutator. So they're fermions, and so they obey anti-commutation relations. And all the other ones are zero. Which means that those other operators anti-commute with each other. And the only thing that I haven't told you then is what the Q's are. These Q's. So the Q's, each component of the vector Q is an integer multiple of 2 pi over the linear dimension of the system. And if you invoke that property, then you'll see that periodic boundary conditions are obeyed. So I'm going to spend 5 more minutes. So you can calculate what the average of this operator is, which is essentially the number of electrons in the state labeled by Q and sigma. And you can write it this way. So these things here are the relative probabilities of a state being occupied by an electron or empty, and they're normalized by their sum. And this is the occupation it says the probability, if you call the probability that a state is empty 1, then the relative probability that it's occupied is e to the minus beta times the energy, and so forth, and then you normalize. And this is equal to when you just multiply it through. Yeah?
Is the first subscript Q prime or not?
This one here?
These
are both Q. If I put a Q prime here, then I'd have to put a Kronecker delta here to say that the average is zero if they weren't the same. It's called the, or you could call it F, it's a Fermi function. And this is basically, this is approximately a step function. At epsilon q equals mu. So what does this function look like? And the width of this step is t. So let's just back up for a second. We have a Hamiltonian of non-interacting electrons whose energy is just given by their kinetic energy measured with respect to the chemical potential. And so the probability that any particular one of these states will be occupied is given by this function, which starts at 1 and falls to 0 in a step-like fashion when the energy of the state is, well, when this is 0 or when EQ is mu. Yeah?
What does epsilon Q represent today?
Say this again, what does?
The epsilon Q.
So when this is equal to this, then this function is equal to 1/2.
Yeah, what does it actually represent before it is equal to? What does it represent?
Okay, so if you establish the number of particles in your box by setting a chemical potential, then the individual electron states with the lowest energy at low temperatures will be occupied, and the ones with higher energy will be empty. And the roll-off occurs for the particles whose energy is equal to that chemical potential that you set. Does that make sense?
Something like the Fermi energy?
It is the Fermi. Well, it would be the, so the Fermi energy is basically mu at t equals 0. At t equals 0, this becomes a sharp step. And the Fermi energy is the highest energy of the highest occupied state. Okay, I think we're out of time. Is that right? Okay, good. Okay, so that's enough for today. Yeah. Epsilon Q is. Oh, sorry. I see the problem. Yeah, I just you're right. Okay, I see. I skipped a step here.
They can talk to Peter and.
That's what that was, sorry. That's this. Sorry, just a notation. Actually, the whole purpose of this is to try to get the notation out on the table, so sorry for that. Mu is the chemical potential. Chemical potential. That's never changed. Okay. Well, I think it's just you need to use
zero.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah.
So, this is a operator which destroys or creates a particle in this state. It's like a field operator. In field theory, it would be psi and psi guy. Okay, except when you go over to the state.